Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothian-McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette.
The political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm head of programming, Connor Boyle. On the podcast today, we're hearing from Roland Allen, a publisher and author whose most recent publication is a history of what we might consider to be a very everyday, even humble object, the notebook. Except it's not just that, is it? Over hundreds of years, a notebook is the place where so many other good ideas have been jotted down, scribbled out, and refined, perhaps to eventually escape its pages and grow out into the real world. Joining Roland to talk about it is Albert Reed, writer, author, and magazine publishing head. He is the author of his own book on the power of ideas, The Imagination Muscle. Let's join Albert now with more.
Roland, welcome to this podcast, and thank you for being here. Tell us about where this book came from. What were the origins of the notebook?
Oh, thank you, Albert. I guess it started with the completely accidental discovery of my grandfather's diaries from before the war. When I was quite a young man, and I'd never known my grandfather. He died when I was very small. And even though there were very small little date book diaries, not kind of big journals, and he kept very minimal entries in them, they were still fascinating, and they really brought him to life in a way which was completely surprising, this unsuspected life that he'd had before he came back to London and started the family and so on. And so, quite inspired by this, I started keeping my own diary, which was kind of my own bid for immortality and to bring myself to life for future generations, etc. And then I suppose once I was a couple of years into keeping a diary, which is 20 odd years ago now, I started noticing other people's notebooks around the place. You mentioned that I work for publishing companies, and although I don't really have a particularly creative job myself, I kept on seeing that designers and authors and artists and the creative people I was working with all really relied on their notebooks and used them very heavily. And I just started to wonder where notebooks came from.
And where did they come from?
Well, from the European point of view, they turn up in Italy, really, in a big way, in about the year 1260. Now, Italy at this time is the sort of the busiest, I guess you'd say, part of Europe. It's full of traders and merchants, and they immediately recognise that paper is the key ingredient in the notebook, has a massive advantage over parchment, which is what they've been using up to this point, and that is permanence. So if you write something in a paper notebook as opposed to a parchment notebook, it stays there, because parchment you can scrape off the ink and rewrite it again, and no one knows, no one can tell.
And that's what was happening, right?
Yeah, and so you could never trust a parchment record entirely. You could look at it and you could say, well, this was written down at some point, but it might well have been changed and I would have no way of knowing. But with a paper notebook, you can record a transaction and a payment or a contract, and so you can trust the written record. And for businesses, obviously, this is completely essential, because you need all trust, all businesses need trust and confidence. And So the arrival of paper notebooks enables people to delegate, for instance, and to form a larger organisation around their trade. And the Italians take full advantage of this, particularly the Florentines. Now, it also lets them play with numbers in a completely new way, because you've got this small little IT device which lets you make all kinds of sums, essentially, and keep them accurately. So you've got, and this is when we see the invention of bookkeeping, and the very word bookkeeping is quite telling, because it's the notebook which is the key part of it. So you can keep an account for multiple customers, you can keep separate accounts by commodity. I looked at one particular set of records where they kept all of their accounts for dealings in cloth, and then a separate set of accounts for all their dealings in wool, so they know what their most profitable trading is and the margins and things like that. And in turn, then you can apply abstract concepts like interest and profit and loss, trial balances. This is the birth of accountancy. And
double entry bookkeeping.
Exactly, double entry bookkeeping pops up at this point. And this enables them to become incredibly good at business, much better than anyone ever before.
And where exactly had paper come from? Had it come from China?
Originally. So about 1,000 years before that. But the Chinese invent paper around the year 200. And having come up with this thing, which is amazingly practical for writing on, they proceed to use it for wrapping parcels mainly for the next 100 years or so. They don't really start writing on it for a while in a big way. But obviously when they do it, it becomes very important, and it gradually moves westward along the Silk Road. And it arrives, the big arrival is around the year 750, when it arrives in the caliphates and Baghdad and the various Islamic, states which run from Baghdad and Persia in the east all the way through to Fez and Morocco in the west, and of course Spain. And in Spain, the Islamic papermakers make the finest paper of all. And it is this paper which eventually comes into Europe when the Catalan king, King James, conquers a small town called Jativa, which is near Valencia, and that's the centre of Islamic papermaking in Spain. And suddenly you have this high-quality paper which emerges very quickly into Europe and has all these sort of surprising consequences.
But it had led to the flowering of the great Islamic golden age of the 9th and 10th centuries as well, before that, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And really the transfer of wisdom from the classical age, the works of Aristotle, had made their way through into the Renaissance I'm simplifying a bit and summarising a bit, but made their way through the Islamic golden age through the use of paper and notebooks into the Renaissance. Is that a correct way of putting it?
Yeah, as I understand it. And what you see in Baghdad and Cairo and the other cities around the year 800 and onwards is sort of hyper-literacy, which you certainly don't see in the West at that time, where you have streets of booksellers and competitive library buildings. So each city vies to have the largest library, the finest collection of manuscripts. And they have a lot of, practices and protocols around manuscript copying, for instance, which are quite different in that environment than they ever are in the West, one side effect of this is that it's quite hard to date and place many Persian or Arabic manuscripts because the copies are so reliable, whereas in the West you can normally place a manuscript quite closely in time and location from that era because it's full of mistakes, and these mistakes get passed down through the copying. But what is interesting is that no notebooks as we recognize them survive from the Islamic world. And I spoke about this at length with a guy called Jonathan Bloom, who's the world expert on this. And he was absolutely stumped. He couldn't think of a notebook, a bound up collection of notes from this period, which isn't to say that they aren't out there somewhere. I'd love to see them, but it's a real peculiarity that the notebook seems to be much more of a European thing.
Yeah, well, one envisages that Baghdad House of Wisdom being stuffed with notebooks, right, and paper volumes which have been lost for for posterity.
And the other problem is that I don't know how many times it was burned down, but Baghdad was burned to the ground a few times.
Yes.
And each time, all of that paper culture was lost.
Yeah, yeah. And what do we have remaining from the Florentine times?
A lot. Right. A lot. So they were very, very assiduous record keepers. And I don't really know why, but they archived things relentlessly. So there are huge archives, which in some senses have barely been scraped into in Florence to this day. And so for economic historians particularly, you can see the annual reports of companies from the year 1300, which I find quite mind-blowing, and lots of them. And you can also see hundreds of the personal notebooks which people keep, because at the end of the day, you've got a thriving merchant class or middle class, which is literate and numerate. And at the end of the day, they take home their notebooks and they start using them for their own fun purposes.
And the point that you make in the book is so interesting about the transfer of notebooks for business, for bookkeeping, for running commercial enterprises to the world of art. And really the beginning of the Renaissance starts with Giotto paper notebooks, taking notebooks out into the countryside. Tell us about that connection.
Yeah, this is something which really startled me when I was looking at the history of it, because quite quickly sort of found when paper arrived in Europe and when we have the first paper notebooks in the archives and so on. But then stepping back and looking else at what else was happening at the same time and realising that it's Dante and Giotto. And Giotto, for instance, was one of the very first Western artists who could draw your picture and it looked like you. It wasn't a caricature. It wasn't the kind of flat, conventional, iconic depiction. A really interesting case study is pictures of popes. We don't know what any pope looked like until the year 1300. And after the year 1300, there are reliable portraits of nearly all of them. So we can see who's fat and who's bald and who's tall and so on. And this is, I think, Giotto is a really key figure here. And the tradition in Florence is, now I can't say that this is history because this is via Vasari, but the tradition in Florence is quite convincing to me, which is that he was just drawing in notebooks all of the time. And it's this sketching and repeated drawing from life, which we recognise now as being the main skill for an artist or a figurative artist. And he was one of the first people to be able to do that.
And could one also say that this is the democratisation of art, in a sense, in that paper allowed artists to work who previously didn't have access to parchment because they weren't monks?
Yes, exactly, yeah.
The writing and drawing were the preserve of academia and the church. Yeah, and this, exactly. This was a new tool, really, that the likes of Giotto took advantage of, which wouldn't have been possible otherwise.
Yeah, and I think you've said it perfectly. The paper was cheap, another thing. It's really hard to sort of compare like with like and say, oh, it was 12 times cheaper than parchment. But it was nearly always, I think, at least a tenth of the price of parchment, and quite often a lot less. And that just meant that you could afford to waste paper. I don't think you could ever afford to waste parchment.
Yeah.
So if you could doodle.
It changed the world of business. It changed the world of art. It changed the world fundamentally in Italy and then elsewhere from that point. Is that right? And then we have Gutenberg and the printing press and the whole explosion of the printed word. But really it starts with paper, the notebook, and this ripple effect of thought, yeah, that it facilitated.
Yeah, I think so. I think if the comparison which one paper historian made to me, Orietta Darold, is that Florence was like Silicon Valley. You have this new technology, this new IT, but you also have pots of money, you have creative inventiveness, you have commercial inventiveness, and all of these people are talking to each other all the time. The painters are talking to the merchants, talking to the authors. They're all connected. And I think it is similar in some ways to the arrival of the computer, which starts off with IBM as being a business machine. And now here we all are watching Netflix and playing on our PlayStations.
And can we talk about Leonardo? Leonardo's notebooks, which I write about as well in my book, The Imagination Muscle, were fundamental. And this comes on to the whole concept of Zibaldone. Maybe we should talk about that first, and the idea of noting, of assembling thoughts on paper. Can you tell us a bit about the history of that? And then let's talk about Leonardo.
So the notebooks which people kept at home were called Zibaldone, which is a Tuscan word which seems to mean salad. And it's a very good image for them, because people would just throw down in their personal notebooks whatever they thought was useful or fun, and quite often a real emphasis on fun. So they would write down or copy down things like Aesop's fables or prayers or recipes or cures for various ailments, or it could be chunks of the classics. Chunks of Marco Polo were very popular, Il Milione, chunks of Dante, for instance. So we have about, we have too many to count excerpts of Dante from Florence, from his own time, for instance. So we know that he was very, very widely read. And you write about this, the idea of assembling existing ideas and selecting them and seeing what new ideas they throw up in when they're on the page. So this is the Zibaldone, and it becomes the commonplace book.
The thing I couldn't quite work out is the Zibaldone and the commonplace book, are they the same thing in your mind? Do you see a difference between the two?
Not quite. A Zibaldone is fun and it's random. That's the thing. And there's no order to it. So most people, when they talk about their creative notebooks these days, they're kind of Zibaldone-ish. They aren't necessarily too organized. And commonplace books arrive a bit later, and superficially they're the same, but they're very organized, and they're actually quite hard work to keep a commonplace book, because you're constantly having, it's like a filing system. So you have a head word on each page, which might be revenge or adultery or justice or any big topic like that. It tends to be big topics. And then when you're reading worthy texts, they tend to be worthy, so it's the Bible or it's Holy Writ or the sort of works of the Church Fathers, typically. You would take out a chunk on the subject of justice and you would write it out and you would attribute it. And then when you next came across something about justice, you would write it down and so on. So you would end up with your own anthology already arranged, and that would let you arrange your thoughts very logically. But it was quite hard work, so it tends to be an educational tool rather than a fun thing. Zibaldone are fun.
And would you put Leonardo in the Zibaldone camp or the commonplace camp? In the Zibaldone camp, I assume.
He definitely came from a Zibaldone culture, but he's really quite sui generis. I mean, he came from a world which was full of notebooks and people used them all the time, but still, there's no one quite like him.
Yeah, I mean, it might be worth just telling us a bit about Leonardo's notebooks. I mean, he wrote thousands of pages of doodles, of drawings, of lists, of architectural designs, of studies of concave mirrors and diagrams, and yet mixed in with these very serious bits of work were, as I said, doodles, shopping lists, you know, little riddles. What I found fascinating as a tool for the imagination, as a tool for the mind to develop ideas and to make connections, was this mix, was this sort of calculated disorder almost of the serious and the trivial, the doodlings of the mind being reflected in the doodlings on the page. What does it tell us about his mind, in your view?
I think he just had the principle that the second something occurred to him, he wrote it down. So one of the things that you mentioned, lists, he was constantly making lists of things that he wanted to research, questions that he wanted to answer. So things which for you or I would pop into your mind, you'd go, oh, how does that work? And it would pop out again, what it does with me anyway. He made a note of it. And these notes gradually sort of formed his own private curriculum. So that's one very important thing. And I think another is that once you've got things down on the page, you can play with the idea. And so the famous one which Walter Isaacson makes a lot of in his biography is that constantly drawing water and constantly drawing long curly hair. and seeing the resemblances between them. And it doesn't really necessarily lead Leonardo anywhere particularly constructive, but you can see he's playing with these ideas all the time, the idea of the curves and ripples and the things, how they look, this kind of fascination.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
It's really a sort of exercise in analogy, isn't it? It's an exercise in finding connections, patterns that... And he writes about the world being the same as the human body, and the blood being the ocean, and the rocks being the stones and the bones, and he's always making these leaps of mind in these areas that you describe, like hair and water and the human body and the world, and one has to draw from that that it's really exercising that power of connection that would then lead into other thoughts. Do you think that's...
Yeah, no, absolutely. Cool. I think you said it better than I could. The another fascinating thing I find about them is it's interesting. On a particular given page, he nearly always just writes about one thing. There may be a doodle to one side, but he's quite focused. You know, a page will be about water running over rocks, and that's it. But he's constantly making notes and telling himself that later on he's going to organize his notes and he's going to turn them into something more useful and more structured. And some of the time he does this and some of the time he doesn't quite get around to it. So when his heir, Melzi, has to, or decides to pull together all of Leonardo's writings about art, about how to paint, and comes up with the treatise on painting after Leonardo's death, he has to pull pages from here, there, and everywhere across the notebooks in order to make this coherent account. And it's quite telling that there's material for lots more treatises in what Leonardo leaves behind, but Melzi just can't face it, I think. You know, it's so exhausting just pulling out the treatise on art that he then...
How many pages are there? Thousands and thousands, aren't
there? I think it's 6,000 leaves or 13,000 pages, therefore. Two pages to a leaf.
I mean, it says in your book that that would add up to something like 1,000 pages a year or something. So it was productivity on a hyper level of energy and curiosity and range that made him who he was. Yeah. And the notebooks were fundamental to that. I mean, could we imagine Leonardo without notebooks, without these leaves? Could he achieve?
If we just had the paintings, what would we think of him?
You know,
would the paintings have happened without the notebooks? I mean, the Mona Lisa was painted during the day, and then the evening he'd go and dissect cadavers and examine exactly how the structure of the face and was made, so that he could go back and paint more accurately in his art. So I think there's that fascinating connection between science and art that he exemplified better than anyone, really.
No, definitely.
And with the artistic process of other artists you write about, the point you make, which is an extremely good one and a very important one, is the work we see on the museum wall is the end of a very, very long process of work, of experimentation, of trial and error, which we sometimes see and we sometimes don't see. In your research, which artists did you find best showed the kind of journey of the artist through their notebooks?
For my living example was Humphrey Ocean, who is a very distinguished painter today. And he's the Turner Professor of Perspective at the Royal Academy. So that's his... apparently, he doesn't have to do very much to retain that title. It goes to show his place in the pantheon, so to speak. But, I mean, going back to Turner himself, you can look at... he was a relentless sketchbooker, always with a sketchbook in hand. And he actually used a particular kind of patent sketchbook, which was effectively rainproof. You had a special pencil and you had specially treated paper so that any line you drew on it would be waterfast, so that if it got damp or got wet in the rain, he wouldn't lose his sketch. Right. Charles Darwin used the same brand of notebook when he was going around the world, and Coleridge used them when he was wandering around the Lake District in the rain writing poems. So you have these little technological leaps. I guess the artist personally who I've followed most closely in that way is Picasso. Actually, you've written about Les Demoiselles d'Avignon as well, because that, if you look at his sketchbooks, you can trace all of the influences coming together. There are hundreds of sketches, most of which are of themselves quite perfunctory. But then you can see them all pulled together in this huge, very striking painting.
Yes, and I forget the number of them. There are hundreds of them, I think. And what one's observing in the progression of these sketches is really the beginning of the 20th century art, or the beginning of cubism, the beginning of these new forms of drawing, the influence of African art, the influence of Iberian sculpture, and how he takes them and produces this painting, which at first is kind of met with horror by his friends and contemporaries and art dealers, but then eventually is recognised as the painting that launches modern art and the modern world in a way. And here in these notebooks you can see the progress he makes, and it's a fascinating record of the mind in the way that that you write about in the book. And Turner the same, and you know this and the Impressionists. So they all came about really through the portability of notebooks, didn't they? And the portability of paint. Paint. I mean, Turner also was able to use different sorts of paint, which he could take with him to Venice and to the Alps and to paint the burning of the Houses of Parliament. Very quickly, he could be on the scene like a sort of contemporary photographer. And that was all new, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think something else, to get back to Leonardo, most of his notebooks remain completely obscure and unlooked at until about the 1890s. And they're sort of owned as prestige objects by various aristocrats scattered around Europe. But they're never really read. They're never looked at in any detail.
Why was that? Because they just were scattered and locked away by private owners.
Exactly, yeah. And obviously the ones with beautiful drawings in them, they would refer to beautiful drawings, the anatomical sketches and things. But anything which was lots of writing, which quite a lot of Leonardo's is, because his handwriting is so atrocious and backwards.
And he writes backwards, doesn't he?
Yeah. Is never really referred to. And it only really comes to light in the 1890s. And I think that after the 1890s, you sense that artists and creative people start to take their own notebooks a bit more seriously. So Picasso, for instance, he kept all of them. Whereas a lot of artists and a lot of writers, you know, they gradually lose them over time. They give them away. They go on the fire.
Yeah.
And from sort of when his name's Richter, publishes Leonardo's sketchbooks and people really understand for the first time what's in there, that you start to see other people taking their notebooks more seriously.
There's a line in your book which I loved about from Hockney saying that if you want to understand an artist's work as a student of art, you really have to sketch that work. And I thought that really brought home the idea of observation really being about interacting with that work at a quite a profound level and taking the time to do your own version of it in order to understand how it was put together. And I think notebooks are such an important part of learning, of education. And there's another line that, you know, if you look at the Industrial Revolution and the James Naismith, the inventor of the steam hammer, you know, he described drawing as the educator of the eye, and I think that's such a good way of seeing it. Of really, you don't see something unless you draw it or write about it or have some sort of closure of your own around your own active participation in that. And the notebook is the way of doing that, and that's been the tool throughout history since the 13th century, as you write in your book.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I love that David Hockney quote. David Hockney's terrific because he's always articulating. He's a great talker as well as a great painter, you know. And a lot of artists don't really articulate this, or you have to sort of squeeze it out of them. They haven't necessarily verbalized it. But I love that Hockney quote about if there's no sketching, if there's no copying, there's no art. You know, that is how the tradition gets handed down. And one thing that's interesting is talking about this, the importance of sketchbooks to art historians, there's often a good deal of scepticism. And they say, well, where are Giotto's sketchbooks? And you say, well, they haven't survived. Who knows?
Yeah.
So there's no smoking gun. And therefore, art historians are very sceptical about it, which is their job. Talk to an artist about it, immediately they get it. And because they know, because they've gone through the process.
The preparatory sketching, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and also the training, you know, what it takes to develop your skills as an artist, to learn how to draw a portrait or to draw in perspective. You know, there's only one way to do it, and that's to do it.
Yeah, but in times gone by, it wasn't just artists, it was, you know, engineers and it was, something, you know, scientists. That use of drawing and noting to observe, to truly learn something. And I don't know about you, but I find it when I'm... If I'm learning something, I write it down. That's the way to and when I'm telling my children how to revise for exams, I say, take notes. Keep writing.
And the problem these days is that you're slightly swimming against the tide because schools are going ever more digital.
I know.
And so the homework comes back and it's, you know, it's multiple choice tick boxes on a computer screen.
Yeah. And do you think we're losing something?
Yeah, very definitely. Yeah, absolutely. And there is really good research on this, really solid research now that they know that, and the Japanese, interestingly, are leading it, because one thinks of the Japanese as being very technologically sort of ahead of us on the curve. In an academic context and out of it, you learn and retain and remember much better if you write notes on paper with a pen or pencil than if you type them. And there are lots of reasons for this, but they measure them by, or they know it by really looking inside your brain. And your brain is much more active when you're writing with your hand than it is when you're typing, which I think is a lesson for authors, I think, in particular, because it's the word processing is so convenient and so easy, and writing by hand is tiresome and long, and you can't cut and paste paragraphs at a whim. But I think it's a really important discipline for thinking things through.
Yeah. I have a theory that novels, that the novel went into decline after the invention of the laptop, the word processor, and really the novels written in longhand have a quality which is hard to replicate if you're writing on a computer.
I wouldn't gainsay that at all. I think that there's probably something to be said for that.
When you're writing a book, how do you put it together?
Lots and lots of handwritten notes. I tend to actually, interestingly, when it's easy, when I'm just writing a chapter and I've got my material and I know what I want to say, typing comes very easily and it's fine. When I have a really knotty bit, and the introduction to this book, I think the introduction that you read is about the 18th version, and that I ended up handwriting, and that was I think when it started to become readable, was when I sat down and did a version by hand sitting in the garden, and it's pages and pages in a moleskin, which obviously I then had to type up and fiddle with and edit, but that original stream of consciousness was done by hand. And so when you're problem solving, I find it much easier to solve a problem by hand. When things are flowing, you can sort of bash out copy, if you like, in a more journalistic way.
I find the commonplacing, the zibaldonia, whatever one wants to call it, of my own, a very, very powerful way of not only organizing my thoughts and having ideas that 6 months later connect with another idea, but also as an exercise in almost in mindfulness of if you're writing things down, if you're taking notes from a book you've read, it's a very calming, soothing, reflective process, which I feel is very good for the soul.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's akin to diary writing. I think any process where you're taking a feeling and putting it into words, or taking a thought and putting it into fresh words, that is, I mean, it's literally mindfulness. You're putting a name to it. What do your notebooks look like? Are they scrappy? Are they neat and tidy?
They're scrappy. They're not very beautiful. I mean, they're spiral-bound A4 notepads, but I got lots and lots of them, and I probably used 20 or 30 of them for my book. And I go through a process of reading a book, marking it in pencil, marking the parts in pencil that I find useful, and then noting them down in a notebook, and then rewriting them down in a notebook around that one particular subject. So I end up noting, writing, rewriting, as I'm sure you do in your work. And it's quite laborious. And friends of mine who are writers say, why don't you just use a very good piece of software you can use? And there are all sorts of digital solutions. But I've never found one that quite, although they have a superficial attraction of efficiency and speed, I don't find them particularly useful to the process of my own thinking, nor do I find that they're very useful in terms of rediscovering things. I mean, I'm working on a new book now where there are elements from my research of the first book that I want to draw on, and I stumble across things in a way that I wouldn't if they were buried in a cloud-based file somewhere, which I probably would never look at again.
So I think that labour pays off.
It does.
From a reader's point of view.
It's counterintuitive and it's labour-intensive, but it does pay off, I agree.
Yeah, I found your book ridiculously easy and a pleasure to read. I mean, it really flows very, very nicely. And technically, I really appreciate or understand how hard it is just to cram that many ideas into a fairly finite number of pages.
Yeah.
And for it not to become overwhelming, and for ideas to flow naturally from one to the other, and for, all of the ideas you're talking about, analogy and imagination and so on are quite abstract. But I think that you can tell that you have thought things through in quite a... And your style also, you depend quite a lot on quite short chapters or chunks of story rather than big blocks of text.
Yes. Can I ask you about what... we're coming to the end, sadly, of this conversation. I wanted to ask you about the very beginnings of this book, which was a story that I was fascinated by because I didn't know it. And it referred to Bruce Chatwin and to Songlines and to his... a passing comment he made about moleskins and how they'd stopped being made. Can you tell us the story that really kicks off the book?
So so Chatwin, I suppose, he's like a post-Leonardo writer, in as much that he takes his notebooks very seriously. And in the Songlines, which I guess is his cumulative work, his last big novel before he dies, which he writes while he knows that he's dying, he makes his notebooks almost the second narrator of the book. They're really, really important, and it's a very striking element of this book, which went on to become a huge international bestseller. And the Songlines was read by an Italian woman called Maria Segrabondi, and she was a kind of a brand consultant or a marketing consultant, and she'd been given a brief by a friend of hers just to come up with a product which would appeal to a nomadic creative lifestyle. So the kind of people we now call digital nomads. But this was the mid-90s, so you had the first emails or popular emails, you had mobile phones emerging, you had EasyJet. So people were suddenly much more mobile and connected in a way which they hadn't been before. And she was tasked with coming up with a product, any product, which this Italian company could sell to these people. And she was reading Chatwin, and she came across his nostalgic piece about a particular kind of notebook he used to like, which was French, and which he had to go to Paris to buy. So that's a nice excuse to go to Paris. And she realized that this was pressing all of those buttons in terms of the aspiration, the creativity. It would signal travel, and it signaled a quite sort of glamorous lifestyle, but also it was easy to manufacture, and it was easy to sell and easy to stock, and it was a recognizable product. And so they spent, I think, 2 years developing the first moleskins.
Can you just, I'm sure most people know what it looks like, but can you just describe the moleskin in terms of its...
Yeah, so the first moleskins, they were very surprising when they came out, because they were notebooks which were finished to a very high standard. They had a lovely black cover, which you almost thought was leather to begin with. They had a silk bookmark, ribbon bookmark. They had beautiful smooth paper, which was cream rather than bright white. They had fine lines, which were very different from school exercise books. They had a very nice binding, so they didn't fall apart. You could lay them flat and they would stay open. They had a little pocket in the back. And at the front, which is a really crucial thing, they had a little... few lines on the front end paper saying, if you find this book, please return it to so-and-so and you will get a reward. And you could put your address in there, just as Bruce Chatwin had done with his notebooks. And you would get a reward because your thoughts and your notes were precious. And the whole idea was that it would elevate the value of the notes that you made. And it would turn your diary from your diary into a sort of significant creative journal. And so it was a marketing trick to begin with, but there's more than the kernel of truth to it, and and it resonated spectacularly well.
It's become it's been an enormous business now, isn't it, Moleskin?
Yeah, and it grew, and not just enormous, but really, really high margin. It's up there with the big tech companies in terms of gross profit as a percentage of turnover. Yeah. And it's a really, really simple product, which is made in China, which... isn't endorsed by rock stars or film stars or Formula One drivers. So I love the story of the moleskin because she played us, Maria Segrabondi, basically, she played us all like violins, and she did incredibly well off the back of it.
There's a wonderful line in the moleskin marketing, I think it's in the paper you get with it, describing it as a distillation of function and an accumulation of emotions that release its charges over time. And I love that idea of... And that really comes back to the whole idea of the commonplace book, the Zibaldonia, this thing that accumulates things and then releases them over time. And I think that's such a sort of elegant way and beautiful way of putting it.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the original Italian, it's, which I won't attempt to quote, it's even more beautiful and elegant. Yeah. That's a nice. And you know, I'm a commercial person. I love buying and selling things, and that story really, really resonated with me, I think.
Yeah, it's a great story, and it's a great way into this book. Well, listen, Roland, thank you so much. This book, The Notebook, History of Thinking on Paper, is really a wonderful, original, fascinating take on really the history of ideas, I would say, through such an important part of history, and in a way that I've never seen it done before. So congratulations, Roland, on the book.
Thank you so much. And congratulations also on your own.
Oh, well, thanks very much. And thank you very much for talking to me and to Intelligence Squared today. Thanks, Roland. Great to talk.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Leila Ishmael and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.